Hi there, and welcome to the Violin Geek Podcast. I'm your host, Laurel Thompson, and today I'm pleased to bring you an interview I recorded a few weeks ago with Dr. Cora Cooper. She is the editor of the graded anthologies Violin Music by Women and Viola Music by Women, as well as quite a few other offerings, which you can check out on her websites, and I'll be linking to those in the show notes. I came across her work last year as the pandemic was wearing on, and between myself and my students, everyone was hungry for new material. I had blown through all of these volumes of sheet music that I hadn't gotten around to looking at for years or ever, and I started searching around on the Public Domain Music Library, imslp.org, and I started going through all of these lists. Particularly, I remember one day I was searching for new viola music. I wanted to find viola music that was actually written for viola and not like violin or cello music that was transcribed for viola. And so I was going down this long list of actual viola music written for viola, and that was really exciting. But with any list of composers, this question starts to pop up as you're looking at these names and thinking, gosh, there are so few female composers, maybe hardly any on these lists. And that led me to some Google searches for music by female composers. And fairly quickly, I came across Dr. Cooper's work and was so excited. I saw, wow, this is 4 volumes for violin, 3 volumes for viola, all this other stuff here. And I went ahead and ordered the violin volumes and was just so pleased to see that someone was thinking along these lines and had done so much legwork, because looking at those lists, you might find 1 female composer, and then there's 45 male composers between, you know, that 1 female composer and the next one, and half the stuff you're downloading, it's not very good and whatnot. So Dr. Cooper has done so much of this for us, and I've really enjoyed sharing some of the tunes with my students and just playing them myself. I mean, it's just nice to see that female composers are out there, and they may not be filling concert halls with their work, unfortunately, but it doesn't mean that it's not out there, and that it's not relevant, and that it's not good. I think maybe that's a question that we might, some of us anyway, might have in looking at programs that are filled with the standard male composers or even modern male composers. We wonder, gosh, where are the female composers? I mean, there's folks like Carolyn Shaw, who's becoming more popular out there as a modern female composer, and there are others, but we just have to wonder, like, well, maybe there were other ones and they just didn't make the cut. And in talking to Dr. Cooper, I definitely got the impression that that is far from the truth. A lot of these female composers were teachers first, so their audience was their students. They wanted their students to improve, and it's not to say that some of them weren't published at one point, but like any publishing, eventually things go out of print. And it's just wonderful to hear the stories of what Dr. Cooper went through to bring some of these pieces to light and share them with all of us. And I really hope that you'll check out these volumes, whether you're male or female. And I have to say, as a teacher, I have noticed, especially some of my younger female students, really light up when I've presented a piece by a woman composer. I think there's that recognition that they too could become a composer. And we might think, especially in this day and age, oh sure, women can do anything. But in my case, I went through all of the Suzuki volumes, was kind of my first step, and there's not a single female composer there. So you're becoming immersed in this world, music, violin, but yet you might be thinking, well, maybe that piece of this world isn't really for me. Maybe I can't do that. And nothing could be further from the truth. We get a melody in our head. We take the time to write it down. We've become a composer. There might be a few more steps to getting that out there and published and played by other people, but just that act of writing down something that has come to you, some melody, you have become a composer. It's kind of as simple as that. And it's just so wonderful that we have record of these women who have come before us in these volumes by Dr. Cooper that we can lean into and that can inspire us, again, males and females, to take those melodies and to do something with them. You know, that's something that I need to do more of these days. It's been a while. Before we launch into the interview, I'd like to read a little bit from Dr. Cooper's biography. She is a professor of music at Kansas State University, where she teaches violin, viola, chamber music, and string pedagogy. She has graduate degrees from the Eastman School of Music and Florida State University. And her work with music by women composers has led to many performances at the Festival of Women Composers at Indiana University of Pennsylvania and lectures in the United States and England. And you'll hear us mention a composer named Josephine Trott. You might be familiar with her Melodious Double Stops, which is probably the most famous works by her. And then there's also a piece called Puppet Show, which is in Barbara Barber's Solos for Young Violinists, Volume 1. Dr. Cooper states, "Spurred on by my curiosity about Josephine Trott, it was hard to believe that this person could have produced the Melodious Double Stops books and the piece The Puppet Show, then disappeared from the musical world. Who was she? Where was she from? What else did she do? Were there more like her? It also struck me around this time that most of my college students had never played a composition written by a woman. That just didn't seem right. I knew from previous research that there was a wealth of music to be found, but a paucity of music available to meet the needs of every level of playing. So, I went on a quest to find fun pieces in a variety of styles that, for the most part, weren't currently available, and that would be playable by beginning, intermediate, and advanced students. There would no longer be an excuse for feeling odd using the pronoun she for a composer." Please enjoy my chat with Dr. Cora Cooper, and I'll see you at the end. Hello, Cora Cooper, and welcome to the Violin Geek Podcast. How's your day going?
It's going great. Thank you for having me.
You're so welcome. I'm really looking forward to hearing more about your project, The Violin Music for Women, or by women. And where are we talking to you today from?
I am in Manhattan, Kansas, okay. Just known as the Little Apple.
The Little Apple. I love that. Yeah. So have you been there for a long time?
Yeah, I've been teaching at Kansas State University for 31 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's amazing. So you landed there and it was the right fit.
Yeah. Yeah. It's been very, very good 31 years.
That's awesome. Well, we'll chat a little bit more in a minute about kind of your background, but let's first dive into your project. Yeah. What was the initial inspiration and just tell us a little bit more about it?
It kind of all started in the early 2000s, and I'd been doing a lot of presentations at women's music festivals, like in the late 1990s and everything. So I was aware of the lack of women's music in general, and even with that awareness and having been working in that area for a while. When I was teaching, you know, the Trott Melodious Double Stops to students, I would always say he when I referred to the composer and be like, oh, wait, no, I mean she. Mm. And I thought, wow, if I'm saying that, you know, what's the concept out there? And realizing how few of my students had ever played anything by a woman composer or even, you know, we just assume they don't exist for so many. And hopefully, you know, that's getting better. But gosh, up through, you know, even till today, people will say, you know, what? Oh, there are women composers, you know, when they find out about it. And it's pretty frightening.
Exactly. I mean, we know they must be out there, but can we name one? Right.
Right. Right. Yeah. There's that video from a couple of years ago that's pretty enlightening. The first time I ever did a presentation on the anthologies at the Kansas Music Teachers conference thing, the first thing I did was go through a series of questions, you know, Have you ever played a piece by women composer, like when you were in college or anything, and get like, you know, four hands? And I say, if it's trots, melodious double stops, put your hand down, and probably all but one would. And then I'd ask them, you know, how many times have they taught their students music by women? Zero. And then the last question would be, how many of your students are female? And you'd see this kind of like, oh dear, kind of a reaction in the crowd. So it's, you know, it's fabulous that people are interested and are trying, but it's a hard road breaking through the kind of the traditional canon.
Well, I have to say, I came across what you're doing because it was early on in the pandemic, and without anything to really prepare for, like, you know, all the concerts and tours had been canceled. And it was just students and lots of teaching and preparing stuff for students. And then I'm thinking, okay, we're getting bored of this stuff. Let's find some new stuff. And everyone's having more time to practice. So it's just, you know, we're able to digest and sight read a lot more material. And I started going through stuff that I had just in my own practice and reading through stuff I hadn't really gotten to very much. And so I was doing a lot more viola and the Lillian Fuchs etudes and stuff like that. And I'm like, oh, this is cool. Then I'm thinking about, you know, there's a Rebecca Clark viola concerto. I'm looking at that. It's like, okay, we need some more. There must be more than the Josephine Trot. And so it's very similar. And then I just started kind of looking around on Google and pretty quickly came across your site and was very happy to see that someone, you know, was thinking about this as well. But other than that, it was pretty sparse to find like any other compilations that I saw anyhow.
And, right. You know, right.
Kind of, you're looking at all of these different pieces out there, but are they for violin? Are they for viola? That's kind of the next issue, right? Mm.
Yeah. And that was kind of a big spur to this is that, you know, I thought, well, how do we change this? How do we make this, you know, available? Because that's the, you know, teachers have no time, as you well know. And so if it's not readily available, if it's hard to find, if people also don't want to just send their money off and not know what they're getting. And it's, so it, we just needed that. And it kind of came in a poof with my teacher from Florida State, Karen Clark. We were having coffee at the ASTA conference in 2003. And we literally looked at each other at the same time and just went, we need an anthology of violin music by women. And so, yeah, that's kind of how it all started, was just this, like, you know, realizing that I had a problem. And then realizing that probably lots of other people had that same problem, and how do we find a path to make it better?
That's wonderful. Yeah, all the best inventions, right, come out of having a need and needing to fix something, needing to change something. That's wonderful. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for doing this.
And it was a labor of love. It really was.
It's just, it kind of opens the world for people to see, you know, all of these different, and I appreciated the biographies that you put in there to include, and it's just nice to know where these women came from.
Yeah.
A little bit about their stories.
So many fascinating lives, really.
Yeah. And what was your process for just starting? So you're having coffee and you're thinking, we need to do this. What was the next step? Like, where did you start with... was it just Josephine Trot? Where did you start looking for women composers?
Well, Trot, and I'm trying to remember when that was, but, you know, I did get kind of fascinated by her and did a lot of research and eventually wrote like an article for the ASTA Journal. But in terms of finding stuff, so she was, of course, one of the first people that I went in doing that research. I discovered there were like other pieces besides the puppet show and like, where are they? How do I, you know, they must be good. She obviously knows what she's doing. And so a lot of the process was pretty random. that people would say something like Karen mentioned Edith Wynne, who wrote all those. If you ever go to a library and look at these dusty little tiny books of, you know, how to study Kreutzer and how to study Fiorillo and stuff, she wrote them all. And around the time that it finally, you know, really got going on the project around 2006, the reason that I could get going on it is because I got a frozen shoulder. Suddenly I couldn't play. And so it was like, well, I have time now and I have to still justify my existence, you know, as a college teacher. So I really, and with all that extra time of not practicing, I would just sit and look at online catalogs for libraries and look for women's names and just do these, you know, sort of completely unorganized searches. So I ended up getting a grant to go to the British Library, which is my happy place. I could happily spend weeks there, and had made my list of what I wanted to look at, and, you know, found a lot of really good stuff, found a lot of stuff that wasn't so great. But that was kind of became the foundation. And another place where I found names was like on the back of old editions. A lot of times the publisher would have a list of their offerings and you'd, oh, who's that? You know, and there's a piece for violin and piano. Let me go find it. And then people would you know, my friends would knew that I was looking into this. So they would give me suggestions. And then some crazy, like sort of random things. Like I was in the Kansas City airport one day with my little cute little Tonarelli case, you know, my red one that looks like a mini cello. And this young woman said, oh, I like your violin case. I said, oh, thank you. And we started talking. Well, it turns out she was a graduate student in composition. And I said, oh, do you have anything for violin and piano? And she said, yes. And like the next day, she sent me this great piece, which is in volume 4, a fabulous introduction to kind of contemporary music right next to Libby Larson. So that's great for her. And, you know, so it was a really interesting and not highly organized search.
Well, and that's okay sometimes.
Yeah.
So, and like you're on the path, right? And so, yeah, stuff starts coming your way and this situation in the airport. I mean, yeah. Mm-hmm. And then you're compiling them. So there's 4 volumes mm-hmm. for violin and it's 3 volumes
for viola? 3 just for viola, yeah. So I thought violists were a little more enlightened. They didn't need the, the 4 volume.
So then you're also compiling them for level.
Mm-hmm. And yeah. And that helped a lot in terms of the search. So I thought about, you know, one of the main considerations I had is, well, what would I want as a teacher? What kind of technical things could people use, you know, more material on? What's fun? What would I like to play? And so, you know, my criteria was that had to be pedagogically sound. There had to be a reason to have it, not just because it was by a woman. It had to be fun to play because kids aren't generally working with pianists much, especially at the beginning level. So it had to be, you know, sustainable by itself. It had to be not readily available elsewhere. Because if it was already available, what's the point of putting it in here? We're trying to make more music available. So I used that as my criteria for what I was looking for. And I also used the ASTA string syllabus. I don't think they've put out a new volume, a new edition of that in a long time. But it's great. It goes through all the string instruments and it has, you know, their graded levels. I think they go 1 through 6 for each instrument. With a description of what that grade level is. So, you know, what kind of bowings it would have, what kind of keys it plays in. So I used that kind of to help me figure out what would fit where.
Where to put everything, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was nice when I was first thinking about ordering. Of course, that's something that we all are looking at. Like, what am I actually getting?
Sure.
I really appreciated seeing, like, I haven't heard of any of these people are pieces, you know,
yeah.
And they're not something that, you know, we're finding readily, like you say, we're not finding
right.
in other compilations.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any particularly fascinating stories that you came across when you were researching the women? Any particular people that stuck out and, I don't know, just kind of made you wonder, why isn't this person better known?
Right. Well, there's quite a few. I was making some notes for myself and it was like, oh, I better stop now. Marga Richter, who was very successful woman composer in the 60s and 70s and has kind of fallen out of favor, I'd say, or less well known. I think it was last year she died, she passed away, but she had these three pieces that were kind of, I can't even remember where I heard about them. When I contacted her about getting licensing permission to include them, first thing she said was, where the hell did you find those things? she's a very feisty lady. Just, and she became, my first publisher, we would call her Aunt Marga because she would just, you know, she just wanted to know everything about you and what was going on. And she was just a delightful, wonderful woman. But finding out, you know, she had written them, these three pieces in the 1960s, for Pierre Salinger's son. Pierre Salinger was President Kennedy's press secretary. And she heard he had a son and they'd just moved to Washington and he played violin. And she thought, well, you know, he's probably lonely. He probably wants something to do. So I'll write these pieces for him.
Oh, wow.
And send them off. And they were at the Boston Public Library, and she was like, how'd they get there? So she was always delightful. Do you know the book, My Friend Flicka, and all those horse books?
Yes.
Well, the author of those is also a musician and composer. And so there's a piece in the second volume, at the end of the second volume, The Sunset Dance, which she wrote. And so that was, you know, I found the piece. I looked up Mary O'Hara and all I saw was like My Friend Flicka. And I was like, what? What is all this about? But she was, and she, I think she graduated from New England Conservatory as a pianist. And eventually moved to Wyoming, and that's where when all the horse books and everything
that
came
makes
into.
Sense. Yeah,
yeah.
Wyoming a couple times in my life. There's lots of space and lots of horses.
Lot of space. yeah, and then this classical period sonata that's in volume three by Madame Delaval, whose whole name I had to write it out, Adelaide Suzanne Camille Larive. She was a very fine harpist and fled the French Revolution because she'd been, you know, a musician for the aristocracy, went to England, and then went back to France in 1802 and had a daughter who was also a very famous harpist and so kind of a family business. But the harp or keyboard part, can be played on either part, was at the British Library, but they were missing the violin part. And I found the violin part at Oxford. So I spent a very geeky afternoon hand copying out the violin part there. And so they can be together again. And so that was a kind of a find close to my heart to make that happen.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
How long had they been parted, right?
Right, right.
At that point, you have to wonder.
Yeah.
Yeah, we come across sometimes in a secondhand store or something, right? We come across just the piano part, just the violin part.
Right.
What happened to the other part?
Yeah. Well, the nice thing, at least if you have the piano part, you've got the violin part too. But in the 18th century, they didn't do a score.
Oh.
The piano part was the piano part. The violin part was the violin part. Okay. So you're lost if you don't have both.
Wow. So you're just seeing like at the top or something.
For the
violin and harp, but there's just nothing there. There's no cues or anything. Wow. Well, good. I'm glad that they came together again.
Yeah.
What you're telling me about the women so far here definitely seems like, you know, they're writing books and they're writing music. I mean, they're having to kind of diversify to have that life. And I know for myself, like needing to wear many hats has sort of been my whole career thing, right? It's like needing to diversify and still be in music, but be doing different things in music. And it sounds like a lot of these women had a similar life approach, career approach.
And the I think the biggest hat for women was always teaching, because that was an acceptable career. There's one woman who I haven't found out a lot about, Grace White, who wrote these fantastic etude books, and some of the etudes actually had piano accompaniment, so I stuck them in there. But she was the first American woman to write violin concertos, which were played by Maude Powell.
Tell us,
And
so what would be the dates for this, roughly?
she was early 20th century. And she taught violin at Syracuse University. One of the biggest surprises to me, I think, in all of this research was how many women were writing both really good pedagogical stuff, both in etudes and in pieces for students, and that got published. And by, publishers like Schirmer and big publishers, and then it all kind of went out of print.
Yeah, you just kind of have to wonder why, right? And why, I mean, there's, all of the male etudes and the Kreutzers and the Wolfarts and stuff, and they're staying in published. And you kind of have to wonder what happened there. Did you come across any theories about that, or?
No, I would say that my theory is more that, early 20th century, but with World War I, maybe the losses of men in general, and people became kind of more open to women. And then as the century progressed, it kind of shut down a little bit. There was also one publisher, Arthur P. Schmidt, who was amazing. He was such a supporter of women composers. I mean, he published Amy Beach, and he published so many of these pieces and etude books and stuff that I found were all published by him. And all of his holdings are at the Library of Congress, and they have his catalogs and everything. So that was another catalog I trolled through and then tried to find stuff.
If you have a champion who can promote you. Yeah, because we think, well, were they just, they weren't as good as all this other stuff. But I mean, looking through your anthology, there's wonderful pieces in there. And, and it's like you're saying earlier, needing to have a piece that can kind of stand on its own as just the violin, so it's fun enough to play for a student to want to do, even if they don't have a piano player near them. But then you put the two parts together, and it's just wonderful. Wonderful duets with just really interesting. Some of them very interesting arrangements with the piano, and kind of emotionally, and just a lot to chew on. A lot to chew on some of the pieces. I mean, so you would think, well, of course this would be getting out there.
Well, and that again, that was sort of my criteria too, is that it had to be good, because otherwise, what a disservice I'd be doing to women composers. It's
Yeah,
like
well,
people would
no, I
go,
think
ooh,
it's all wonderful. So, yeah, it just seems very, I guess, confusing why, certain people, and in this case, a whole gender, just isn't really getting out there.
Well, I think, I mean, one of the things that I kind of come across is that people are very tied to their lineage of the books that they were taught. And then with Suzuki, that's become so big in the United States, and not a woman in the 10 books. And so part of my evil plan was that this would all be short pieces that could be infiltrated, integrated into the standard canon, so that it so that maybe teachers would be more willing to teach a 2-minute piece than, you know, something that might take the student the whole semester, you know, a big sonata like is it Amelia? There are two Meyers, and one's Emily and one's Amelia. I forget which one. She's got an amazing violin sonata that sounds, you know, it's very Brahmsian. That's, you know, it's a half hour long piece. So are teachers going to tackle that, or are they going to go to standard literature?
Right. And a lot of people are maybe needing to follow some sort of, like you say, they're following their lineage. I know I certainly have.
Oh, me too. Yeah.
And then finding supplements like your work here. But then, maybe they have exam systems that they're trying to follow.
Right.
They're doing, AB, RSM, or they're doing one of the other exam systems or something. And just like whatever's on that list, right?
Right. Although they've been, I'm not sure about AB, RSM, but a lot of those, the University of West London just came out with a new one. And I'm completely in love with it because it has so much diversity in it, not just women, but all kinds of different styles, different composers, composers of color, Asian composers. I just think they did a phenomenal job. That's but yeah, awesome. I tend to think less about those organizations because we don't really have them as much in the US. ASTA keeps trying And ASTA has put some women composers on their lists as well.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Yeah.
I've seen, because I've had students in different parts of the world, and they have various exam systems.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like in general, a lot of them are getting a lot more diversified, which is great, like you're saying, whether it's time period or genre, you know, a lot more fiddle tunes or just different things. Still women are not that much, but a little bit more. There's the AMEB in Australia.
Oh, okay.
I was impressed. They had a lot more women in that comparatively, but still, still tons, but But anyhow, this idea of everyone's kind of following some kind of guide, or they're following the teachers that came before them that they learned from. And so what are your tips for, I suppose, just integrating this into a teaching studio, and how can we use these volumes and bring this to our students?
The first volume, the beginning volume, is not a true beginning volume. That's in terms of, like, if you compare it to Suzuki Book 1, the earliest pieces in that probably would come towards the end of Book 1. And Claire Allen, who's a violinist, violin teacher and violinist in Virginia, she was an early adopter, and she's been using it for years and years. And she came up, she's very, very methodical and you know, pedagogically, you know, organized and everything, which I have to confess I've never been. And so she did come up with a guide for some of the pieces in volume one, which she let me post on the blog on the violinmusicbywomen.com website. And let's see, I had to look up when it was. So guest blog in July 2016, if anybody wants to look that up. And so she talks a lot about integrating the anthology pieces from the first volume. She's, I think, maybe come up with some stuff for the second volume as well, in with Suzuki in particular, because that's her foundation in her teaching. Although she's really branched out, she is all about diversity, and all of her students work with the anthology and work with Rachel Barton Pine's Music by Black Composers. And she has some Asian tunes and things that I can't remember what the book is. So it is possible, and you can still keep them along that path, and you can use the supplemental material to enhance what they're doing. And some of the pieces in the anthology she likes better than in the Suzuki for introducing like high three or different concepts. And then some, you know, kids have trouble in different ways. So if somebody's having trouble with a certain thing and what you use just kind of marches on, why not supplement, give them more experience with that problem?
Yeah, I found that if there's like a certain, we're learning a certain finger pattern, like you're saying, the high three, the low two, low one, something like that. And it's like, rather than force the student to stay on that one piece until it's perfect,
right.
you know,
right.
Supplementing other pieces that might be interesting and see, oh, and see, this has that same thing that we need to do. And yeah. you never know what sounds are going to spark a student's interest too. I mean, everyone is unique in that way. And I think there's, in my experience, there's some common threads with students, but then you have to keep on kind of throwing stuff at them to see. Mm-hmm. And then there might be, oh, I really like this piece. So now I'm actually going to dedicate myself to learning that concept or, you know, that technique, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it seemed like I did read through that blog post and it seemed like she was, you know, looking at the key signatures a lot and how those would blend with something like Suzuki, which makes complete sense, and other techniques and stuff like that. So yeah, we can put that in the show notes and people can
Oh, awesome.
Get that as a, yeah. as a way to start to integrate. Cause yeah, like you're saying, I mean, when we're marching along with this process of teaching that we've carried on from our teachers, it can be a little bit daunting, I think, at first to just figure out how this would fit. And thankfully, I mean, just in my lifetime, it seems like there's a lot more acceptance for just variety in the classical teaching world, and we can expand. Yeah. And
I just can't imagine teaching the same thing over and over and over for 20, 30 years.
Yeah.
Just, you know, I mean, there are basics that I, you know, kind of go to pieces, but my goodness.
Yeah.
I can't imagine. Yeah.
I'm always, you know, I have favorite pieces, of course, that I think we all do to teach, but it's kind of nice when not every student is working on that piece for a while, you know, and it's like, oh, I haven't really taught this piece for quite a while. Yay. We get to come back to it.
And, yeah. That's also a consideration, you know, with siblings and all that. If you don't have the supplements, if you don't kind of trick them into not knowing, you know, oh, well, you're in book four and all, you know, that kind of stuff, then, you know, that's where the supplemental material can also be very handy.
Yeah, especially like a younger sibling coming up. You know, just, oh, comparing, you know, the comparison to the older sibling, or just feeling like, you know, they're just, I mean, sometimes they want to really follow in their sibling's shoes.
Right.
Sometimes they want to do their own thing. So yeah, I've definitely found that as well. Mm-hmm. It's like, let's get you playing some of your own pieces. This is just for you. And
yeah,
I totally agree. Well, and let's just talk a little bit about the viola volumes too.
Uh-huh.
Those, they share a lot of the same pieces that the violin volumes had, but it seemed like the third one in particular was just almost completely its own material. And these were pieces, at least in that volume, that were written for viola. Is that right?
Yes. Yes. The string world is really violin centric. I started doing some preliminary research on maybe doing a cello series, which is not going to happen immediately, if at all. And, you know, they don't have that same wealth of beginning material, pedagogical material. And it's like, gosh, but the cello is so different, you know? So with the viola, you know, I thought about it a lot, like, okay, can I find material for the earlier volumes? And it just, you know, I decided this is good stuff. Whatever I think is usable, I'll go ahead and transfer. But I did, even in the first two volumes, I wanted to have viola specific ones, and that's where the commissions came in. But the third volume, yeah, I'm actually probably most proud of that third volume of any of them, because I was determined, you know, so 8 of the 10 pieces are viola originals. And then, you know, I had to keep Josephine Trott in there. So she got transcribed. Also, I think that's just such a fun piece in a Spanish garden. It gets, you know, why shouldn't violas have a fancy, you know, showpiece kind of thing. And then the Branscombe, an old love tale, which I just thought, oh, this would sound so nice on viola. And it really does. So yeah, I love that volume. I'm very, very enamored of all those pieces.
How did you go about commissioning the viola works that you did commission specifically for the project?
Well, in the first volume, let's see, there are some by Wendy Ireland, who is an Australian composer, and Mary Cohen, who I adore her stuff. I've been a fangirl for years and years. I actually wanted to get something from her for the violin volumes, but I could never find her contact information. So I had written a blog post about her stuff, and she saw it, and she actually emailed me, and you know, to say thank you or whatever. And I was like, ooh, I was complete fangirling, yeah. And so I went ahead and commissioned some stuff for the viola volumes once I could get in touch with her. Wendy, I found through the Australian Music Center. Which is a great resource. They have a lot of women composers. And she had written this little piece for viola and piano called Sonolento Gatto, or the, you know, Sleeping Kitty, which was originally a choir piece that had words, and there's a whole story and everything like that. So I found that and loved it and contacted her. And she thought somebody was pranking her because it's, you know, she got this email from Sleepy Puppy Press, and this piece was, you know, Sleepy Kitty. She thought, oh, come on, who's having me on here? But finally got over that. So somehow she responded back, and I thought, oh, it would be so nice. You know, here's the Sleepy Kitty is slow. I thought, well, we need, you know, a first and a third movement, right? And then we were having so much fun, we couldn't stop. So I think, let's see, are there five total? I think one of them is in volume two because it was just more musically mature, the romance. And they put together as kind of a choose your own adventure. You can play any of them separately. You can put them in a suite in any order you want, as many as you want. And they're such delightful pieces. They're a little trickier. So that's why the first volume of viola is longer than the first volume of violin, is that we just were having too much fun. They're very, very clever. I mean, she makes in two of them, you use cat bell and you hang it on the scroll, or, you know, the woman who initially recorded them for Wendy, she ended up with a cat collar that she put on her ankle because she couldn't get there. So she's shaking her ankle. The piano parts are tricky. The piano parts are pretty sophisticated. And then for the first volume, Mary Cohen transcribed a couple of violin points. So Lean Mean Tango, which is just a really dirty tango for a young child. I mean, it's a great piece. And then Night Flight, which kind of in most of the volumes, the last piece in the volume is kind of like a teaser or a graduation piece. Like, here's where you can go next. You know, there's just a little bit, you know, of whatever the next volume would be.
Nice. We find that in Suzuki too, right? The Gavotte at the end of book one, and we go, well, book two is going to be a little easier at first, just to say, like, yeah, this was a push, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So Night Flight has some optional shifting or going up to a harmonic or something like that, and it's kind of a perpetual motion. Mary wrote a new piece for volume two, The Ruined Castle, which is pretty cool because the viola part is all based on a whole tone scale.
Okay.
It's like, for violists, get used to these sounds. They're going to be with you for the rest of your life. You know, these more contemporary sounds.
Yeah, absolutely.
And yeah, has a whole story behind it. And then the romance, and also another piece that Wendy had written already, Irish Fancy, which is a great kind of Celtic thing. Is in volume two.
Yeah, there are a lot of different sounds. And so people who are thinking about checking these out, I think, first of all, you know, you mentioned that it would be true for the viola volume as well, I assume. But we're not starting, like, you know, on day one. This is more,
right,
you know, someone who's not super advanced yet, where book one starts. But, you know, we can at least play simpler songs and simpler keys and stuff like that, G major, D major, this sort of thing, right?
Yeah. It does move into A major pretty quickly, so the high three becomes necessary. But yeah, the viola is very similar.
So then I wanted to just go back to the commission. So you were having so much fun going back and forth. So what was the process of that like? Like, were you, they were sending you samples and you had some input in that as well, or you were kind of brainstorming about it initially and then they came back with something, you know, kind of taking these ideas. Yeah. I mean, it sounds like a nice process for you and for the composer going back and forth a little bit.
Yeah, it really is. With Mary Cohen, I just said, do your thing. Just surprise me. With Wendy, we did a little bit more back and forth, and I think we talked a little bit about what kinds of techniques we might want involved. She was a cellist, and unfortunately died in 2018, fairly young, of breast cancer. But she was just a delightful person, and we just really had fun, and she would send me samples and I would get very excited. And there's an in volume one, there's a the Kansas Memory Suite. That was my first commission. Hannah Bartel Greenig now was one of my students, and she was a composition major, but violin was her main instrument. And so I talked to her and I very specifically asked, you know, I want string crossings in one of the movements, and I want, let's say pizzicato, because when do they get to do that? And I want something nice and lyrical. And then what about some kind of perpetual motion? And those pieces are everybody's hands down favorite. She just, you know, they've been great. And it's been picked up like by that University of West London anthology graded program. It's just so much fun to play. It's really terrific.
I've shared that one with a few of my students, and they've really enjoyed it. And yeah, that diversity you talk about, having the, you know, the running eighth notes in one movement, and yeah, there's the pizzicato in another, and it has a lot of nice diversity. And how wonderful that, you know, through commissioning this piece, and then this is your student, and then now it's being picked up by this other organization. I mean, it's just wonderful to see these things growing, I imagine.
It is. Yeah. A lot of times I feel like I'm a midwife or something. Trying to bring these things into the world.
Yeah. One thing at a time, right? And you just see things, spreading their wings and pieces kind of taking flight on their own a little bit once the momentum starts. Yeah. That's great. And I definitely encourage, if you are thinking about the cello volumes, I think that would be wonderful too, but I know it must be a lot of work.
It is a lot of work, but it's also kind of fun. I think the biggest, the two big considerations with the cello volumes are, one, I'm not a cellist, and I have a colleague who would be interested, except she's gotten herself very, very busy. And then the licensing, because most of it would still be would still be under copyright. I found some really good beginning things. And so it's kind of like, okay, well, that gets expensive.
Yeah, we don't think about those considerations until we get into a project like this, right?
Right.
Is it 50 years? What's the...
Oh, it's very complicated.
When they have passed away.
Yeah. In the US, it's not quite that. It's more like it's by date. And then if they renewed it by a certain time, then it's still still under copyright. And if they didn't, it's very complicated. And I've gone to the Library of Congress a few times to do searches and all that, because I don't want to step on any toes. So.
Yeah. Well, I mean, legally, all of that's very important. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, before we leave this portion of the talk, is there anything else you wanted to mention about the project?
I just this summer had a former student of mine who I'm proud mama, just finished her master's with distinction at the Royal Academy of Music in London. She recorded all of the first two volumes of the viola stuff. So that there are now sound files for all the viola pieces and on the violinmusicbywomen.com. Viola Music by Women was already taken. So I just tagged on to the old website, but they're all there. And with videos, I asked her for the Ireland ones with the bell stuff, would she do a video instead? So people can see, you really can do this.
The sound files are so helpful.
Yeah.
We need to hear what things sound like. And was it, let's see, the first violin volume, I think you also had just the piano accompaniments.
Available. Yes. Right. Yeah. They came in later. I had a pianist do them for a presentation I was doing. And then I thought, let's just finish them all and get them up there for download.
Yeah. Yeah. That's all super helpful.
So. Yeah.
Yeah, well, it just keeps growing. And then you have all of these other things on there, some more Josephine Trott etudes that I saw. And
yeah, they're really interesting because they're in first position. But the first one, which I'm calling Easy and Progressive Etudes, actually kind of pulled from a method book that she had. And then the second one, the 28 Melodious Studies or something, I mean, that is an etude book intact, and they're all in first position, but the ones in the 28 are not easy. I mean, even though they're in first position, they're not particularly easy, but in both cases they're all duets. There's a second violin part for all of them.
Well, it'd be nice to play. I mean, as much as I think we all have loved and hated, I suppose, her double stop books, right? I mean, they're also quite some challenging material in there.
Very much so.
It'd be nice to, just see what else other than, what's in the anthology. And of course the puppet show and stuff like that, that's been around for a while, but see what else that she's created.
There are a couple other of etude books of hers. One that's a shifting book that gets a lot into like arpeggios and thing.
Well, so people can check out the anthology at violinmusicbywomen.com.
Mm-hmm.
Put that link there. And then what's the link to the Sleepy Puppy? Because that has these other ones that we're just mentioning.
Right, right. Sleepypuppypress.com.
Okay.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Well, so what got you into music? When did you start?
Oh, this is almost, it's kind of embarrassing. In fourth grade, my best friend's mother insisted that she take violin in the school. And so I decided I'd go along with her because we could get out of math class together.
So. Funny, I have kind of a similar story. My best friend started taking violin lessons and she had seen Itzhak Perlman playing on Sesame Street. And she had, her godmother was in a wheelchair, had polio. So really, saw something in Itzhak Perlman and this guy can play violin. So then she just announced, I'm going to play violin. And of course you can't let your best friend do something you're not doing, right?
Absolutely.
So yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
So, and then you fell in love with it, or was it kind of a process of?
I just kind of kept plugging away. I didn't have private lessons until I was 13. And my best friend quit after 2 years, by the way. And my first teacher, who I studied with through high school, and even her husband was the teacher at the University of Vermont where I did my undergraduate. So I moved on to him, but she wasn't going to let me go. So we had also an etude lessons with her every week, but just, her name's, Evelyn Reed. And she was just such a fabulous person, fabulous teacher. She studied with Galamian and Delay and stuff. So, I came in for my audition with her and played, Little Brown Jug from the Applebaum second book, and she must have been like, yay. But she was just she really nurtured my love with great sarcasm usually, but it was just she just really clicked for me. And so, yeah, that's what kept me going.
And was it a gradual process as well of kind of coming to the point where you wanted to make a career of this, or was there some certain moment or experience when you said, this is what I'm doing?
Yeah, I always, you know, in high school, when you start exploring the whole idea of, you know, what am I going to do with my life? I explored everything except music. I was like, oh, no, I'd never do that. And I don't know where it came from, but I was like, I mean, I remember it very clearly. I was just sitting on the stairs and my mother had a friend over and they were talking in the kitchen. And I just kind of went, bing, I'm going to be a music major. And it literally never looked back. And I went to my next listen. I was all excited. Oh, Mrs. Reed, I want to be a music major. And she looked at me and she said, I know. She knew me better than me.
Especially at that age, we have to come to things on our own, don't we?
Oh, yeah.
And then, so then you became a music major. And and then during the college years, is that when you're thinking about teaching as well? Or was that later? Were you more on a track to thinking you wanted to primarily perform? Or
No, actually, I really wanted to teach. Mm-hmm. I wanted to teach college level. And I'm very lucky that everything I wanted to do happened. my first teacher, she kind of early on, like when I was 16, even she would use me as her assistant kind of thing with, like, especially in the summers, giving some of her students lessons instead. And and she was also really, really good always when she wanted you to change your pinky or to do, you know, more of this in the bow or whatever, explaining why you needed to do that. So, I mean, I built over those, you know, years between 13 and 18, whatever, kind of this understanding of the mechanics of the instrument rather than just, you know, playing pieces and stuff. It was like, oh, well, this makes this happen and all that kind of stuff. So really has helped me to this day. I still use things, present things the way she presented them to me, to my students.
Sounds like, yeah, you had just such a wonderful, supportive atmosphere there. Yeah. And being able to know exactly why you're making that adjustment versus, here, just do that.
You know? Right, right.
I can see how that would really nurture you wanting to share that. You have all mm-hmm. this knowledge at that point, right?
Yeah. I also, you know, I think I like fixing things. When I took the aptitude tests in high school for, you know, what career should came back that I should be an auto mechanic. So
wow.
I kind of feel like really that's what I do. Yeah, that's what I do. But with people's bodies and the violin. Why isn't that working? Let's see. And maybe if we do this.
Yeah, well, it takes a certain brain and I guess suppose patience, right, for that troubleshooting and being able to first identify something, see that something is awry, and then to have a variety of different tools to use to try and figure out how we can fix things. And we have similar bodies but very different bodies at the same
right.
time,
right? Right. So
yeah, having that ability to look and see, well, this is where we need to go. We need to get back and drive.
Yeah. I was also really, I lived like an hour and a half's drive from Meadowmount. And the Reeds in the summer would take a bunch of us over to there for the public concerts on Wednesdays and or Sunday nights. And so I got, you know, this was in high school. So I just, you know, you see these Galamian students parading in front of you every week for, you know, a bunch of summers. And it's kind of like, I sort of developed a template, like an image in my head of, oh, that's what a violinist should look like. And when here's this student and, you know, for their body, you know, what do they need to match that template?
Yeah. Well, Galamian, of course, for people who don't know, one of the major violin pedagogues, at least in the U.S.
Yeah.
He came to the U.S. Mm-hmm. But his book on technique, and I mean, I think I went through that.
Yeah.
A lot of us, at least in the U.S., have used that.
And, oh, yeah.
Yeah. So you get to see, like you say, the template and how can we fit this individual body into that? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I do that very much as well. It's good that you got that early start with being able to assist as well and mm-hmm. have that support. Well, everyone is always asking, I suppose, is there, a perfect practice routine or is there... I wonder if you have any tips. I always just say, making regular practices.
Right,
probably
right.
The first and the best step we can take. But people wonder, how long should I be doing the scales for? Should I do mm-hmm. scales first or should I do something else? Do I need to do etudes? When do
right.
I put pieces in?
Yeah. Well, the way I used to practice... And the way I have had to learn to practice since my shoulder injury and kind of other knock on things are very, very different. For many years in my younger years, I'd be like, oh, if I don't have 2 hours, it's not even worth starting, like I wanted that foundation. And, now I'm like, ooh, 15 minutes, and so I've had to learn to be very efficient in my practicing because I can't play very long at a time. And so I can't, I have various practice techniques that work well for me. I don't know, I came up with a practice flow chart a few years ago. I came home from teaching one day and I was like, no, my students know how to practice, and I just kind of scribbled this thing out. And so it's like, it's not fast enough. Here's what, here's what you do. And so I've, I've had to replace just bulk practicing, which I think I really relied on a lot, with intelligent practicing. Mm. And so there are some wonderful things on violinmasterclass.com, like with Kurt Sausman's house, where he's explaining things and now here's this exercise for that. And I use a lot of those. I found very effective. There just some things. I did go to Burton Kaplan's Music Mountain thing one summer and got some good practice techniques out of that as well. And scales, I'm a big fan of warming up. But when maybe you can only practice 20 minutes, how much time can you really devote to good solid warming up? So it's a mixed bag. And I do think what you say, the consistency is probably the most important aspect of it. Just showing up every day, getting it out of the case. Because then you have a little, it's we're athletes. We have to be in shape to be able to do anything that we want anybody else to hear anyways. There is a new Mary Cohen book that came out, I think, last summer that is fantastic. It's called, did I bring it up here? Technique in Practice, yes. And it's a compilation of exercises that she's come up with over the years for her own use when she's been out of shape. And there's 9 or 10 sets of these, and they kind of are progressive, or they kind of build on each other. And they're really interesting because they're not at all what I would immediately go to for getting back in shape. And it's like, and they work so well. It's a fabulous, fabulous book. And so it's targeted at adults more than at children or anything. But it's
just level wise or more just because it's more technical and we have to kind of have a little of both,
like fairly early on. She's got this one shifting exercise where you're going from like F sharp down in first position on the E string up to fifth position. and then up to sixth position, same notes, up to seventh, up to eighth, that way. And so yeah, for younger students, it would not be suitable.
A little overwhelming. And
yeah.
I think I've seen that title, but I haven't checked it out. That's helpful. Do you have any other examples of exercises? You said just not stuff that you would necessarily think to go to, but anything else that kind of struck you as interesting, but then very effective in that book?
Yeah, she'll keep. I always think of getting in shape as my left hand. She has a lot of right hand things as well, like some you know, string crossings, cords, things like that. Even like a little thing that you can get it faster and do saltando with. And then a couple of pages of bowing variations that are very nasty. I still have not quite mastered those. And it's she starts off just talking about posture and finding a weightless balance. And she's got a great analogy of, you know, being in water kind of up to here and letting your arms float, which I found. And I did it with a pedagogy class this summer. And we were all like, oh, that feels so good. Oh, that's, and I watched them, you know, because it was an online class. And every single one of them just kind of their shoulders relaxed and they just, you know, took on this great posture. So yeah, it's just some very, very brilliant and slightly off the beaten path things. And it kind of brings it, your whole body together. And at the end of every set, she's written a little etude that is comprised of all the techniques that were covered in that set.
Nice. Yeah. So. It sounds like kind of setting you up for the practice, setting you up for the technique.
Yeah.
Like you're saying with the posture and the long shifts, you know, really kind of mm-hmm. the bigger picture maybe rather than.
Right. So it's not hopefully teaching you new things. It's finding what's the direct path to make this work again, if you're out of shape.
Right. Integrating.
Yeah.
Integrating. Yeah. I like the water analogy. It kind of reminds me of some like Alexander technique type, mm-hmm. type approaches and stuff. And that, yeah, getting that whole upper body to support the instrument, not just the hands and the fingers. Right.
Right.
So yeah, we'll have to check that one out too.
Yeah.
What was the title again?
Technique in Practice. And it's published by Faber.
By Mary Cohen.
Okay. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any advice for students? So you're teaching at a college level and so you're at, tell us a little bit about your teaching now. You're at Kansas
State University.
You've been there for quite a long time.
Yeah. Yeah. And retiring in May. Yeah. Very excited. We are, the majority of our music majors are music education, but we have a good chunk of performance majors as well. You know, where it's been interesting because growing up where I did and, you know, Galamian 90 minutes away and everything, you know, it's very different, in Kansas, in the backgrounds of the students when they come in and all that kind of stuff. I think it's encouraged me to be creative, mm-hmm. and to find a way, again, finding maybe shortcuts. How do we get them to where I would like them to be?
Shortcuts as far as technique or.
Right. Just leapfrogging. And a lot of times what I find is that it's a question of understanding the concept as opposed to needing to spend hours developing a certain physical technique, or there's one little clue that somehow it either wasn't taught or wasn't understood that revolutionizes everything. So it's kind of like digging and trying to find those things that, again, I find pretty fascinating.
The little missing puzzle pieces that.
Yes.
Yeah. And going back to that, the practice and, you know, if you have 2 hours and you're just kind of going through the motions versus the 15 minutes and can you, like you said, practice intelligently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, so that these students can kind of get to that phase. And we're all kind of in that phase in some set. I mean, even if we're in a big metropolitan area and we have countless teachers we can take from, I mean, there's only so much time in the day.
Exactly. I couldn't believe how much time I had in my life when I couldn't practice those, 2 to 3 hours a day.
Yeah, so having those, finding those missing pieces. And is there a kind of a method you take with the students? Maybe you have like a hierarchy you're thinking in your mind, or just like what's your starting point, like when you get a new student, to kind of figure out like where do we go first? What do we need to fix first?
Mm-hmm. I like to kind of look at what's going to give us the biggest bang for the buck first, both because, when you take on a new student, you also have to earn their trust. So you want to make a difference. Usually it's the bow in terms of getting them to be able to produce more sound, a more beautiful sound, more ease in the bowing and all that kind of stuff. Sometimes it's the left hand. If the left hand is really, really tight, how do we make it dramatically easier if possible? So I'll usually pick one or the other hand to focus on at first and earn their trust.
Yes, the rapport is so important. And yeah, I know I had a few teachers where they just wanted to completely overhaul something. But I trusted them. So I was willing to do that work. And I saw the results. But yeah, if we don't have that, then we're not going to start.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for chatting with us today and sharing all of this knowledge and experience you've had in your project. And I hope others will check it out. I've just really been enjoying checking out the violin volumes. I have to get into the viola volumes a bit more and check those out. But being able to, it's a whole new frontier, right? Coming out of the pandemic. And
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I hope that we learned from it. Because I kind of see, well, we're just going back to what we did, because really an awful lot of creativity came out of the pandemic.
Yeah.
And an awful lot of what are these other ways we can do things? Yeah. And I don't want to go back to the pandemic, but I don't want to lose that either. I think it was in that way an exciting time. So, but yes, thank you for the opportunity to talk about it and to just have a good conversation with another violin geek. So,
So you're retiring fairly soon. What are you looking forward to?
Well, I'm looking forward to having time to hopefully increase my practice time and to be able to do that intelligently and over a period of time. And just to kind of like go, and what do I want to do? And have some time, and Sleepy Puppy's gonna stay with me, so I'm looking forward to getting some more offerings there. I actually commissioned from our oboe teacher here at Kansas State, Alyssa Morris, who's a fabulous composer, the Sleepy Puppy Suite. I had this picture of four dogs, one of them mine, standing at a fence looking at me as I was coming up to pick up my dog from doggy daycare. And just the personalities of each one were just so distinct. And Alyssa just writes things that often have great humor and everything. So she has written me a suite of four pieces that each representing the personality of the respective dog. So I'm going to premiere that actually in a couple of weeks. So that'll be available sometime this summer, probably from Sleepy Puppy. Yeah.
The sheet music.
Yeah.
Awesome. Tell us about your dog. Is this the, so your logo on Sleepy Puppy, is this?
This is the dog. Yes. well, she used to be brown. She's pretty gray now. And cause that was, gosh, I was just thinking about that today. That was like 2013 that I opened my own publishing business. Okay. And so, yeah, she's gone gray. She's a miniature Labradoodle. And she was the runt. So she's only about 13 pounds.
Oh, wow.
Really tiny. Yeah. And very long legs. And she's a hoot. She's her thought processes are mysterious. She's very smart.
Huh?
Yeah, yeah. So yes, her piece in the suite is very ethereal and very, very mysterious sounding. So
I love it. I tend to have images or scenes. Like every piece to me is kind of a soundtrack of some sort, right? Mm-hmm. So I love, when pieces are coming out of real life situations like that,
Right.
Kind of explore what that scene was, what this puppy was.
Right.
Personality. Yeah. Wow, we'll look forward to checking that out.
Yeah. It's a fun piece. It's tricky, but it's fun.
Awesome. Well, anything else you'd like our listeners to know? Let's maybe just run through the websites again. And
okay.
Everyone has that.
Sure. So kind of general information about the anthology is at violinmusicbywomen.com. And all the sound files for both the violin and the viola anthology are there. Still, I don't have everything in volume 4 recorded, but we'll get there. And then the publishing company where you can get the anthologies and much, much more is sleepypuppypress.com.
Well, thank you so much. And I wish you all the best with your retirement and wrapping things up there in Kansas. And we're excited to see what happens next with your project and everything you're doing. It's wonderful.
I'm excited to see what happens next too. And thank you so much for the opportunity. It's been great to talk with you.
You're welcome.
Nice to have a new friend.
Yeah, exactly. You're welcome. And thanks again to Dr. Cora Cooper for sharing her stories with us, this quest she went on to bring these pieces to us. And I do hope you will check them out on her website, sleepypuppypress.com. There you can order a print version of any of the volumes in the anthology. You can also download digital versions. And she has so many other interesting etudes and pieces. I'm looking forward to checking out some more stuff there soon. And I highly recommend you also head over to violinmusicbywomen.com, particularly for Cora's blog, which is wonderful. I will link to the post that she mentioned earlier, talking about how one might integrate the anthology into the first couple volumes of the Suzuki Method. But she has a lot of other posts on there with tips for different pedagogical materials, and she profiles many of the composers she mentioned today. So you could spend a while on there. It's a great resource. And we wish her all the best in her retirement. I'm sure she'll get some much needed rest and then probably launch into another project. And I just can't wait to see what that is. I definitely put my vote into the Cello Music by Women, I think, but I'm sure she will follow her passion. So again, I'm Laurel Thompson, and you can find me at my website, laurelthompson.com. That's LaurelThompson. There you can find information about my performance, my teaching, and my recordings. I've been sharing some sample cuts from the latest album with my partner Dan Frechette in recent months, and we've been performing a little bit, which has been really nice. You can also check out the Violin Geek blog, which is sort of the companion to the podcast. Certain topics seem better suited to the podcast, especially interviews, versus other topics that seem better suited to written language. And so if you want to check out the blog, you can head to my website and click the Violin Geek tab, and there you'll see the blog. Some recent topics that I've covered have been, should left-handed players play lefty? That was kind of interesting. That was a student question that I got recently. And I came to find out that there are actually a lot more left-handed, some interesting lefty violin players out there currently and in history. So you can check that out to see who those are. And I loaded up some YouTube clips. You can see them in action too. It looks so bizarre. But anyway, they are out there and they play beautifully as well, left-handed. I also did a recent blog post about how to improve the sound of your violin other than practicing. And those tips are, of course, relevant to viola or cello players as well. And then recently I also dove into the rather psychological topic and tricky topic of how adult learners could sort of train their brain and their psychology to learn more like a child, with that kind of, you think of children as just being like sponges and they are just absorbing everything. So I attempted that topic as well recently and would love some feedback on any of this stuff. So you can, of course, send me an email. It's laurel@laurelthompson.com. That's again, laurelthompson.com. And if you have any comments or suggestions for the podcast, maybe you have someone you'd like me to interview or a topic you would like me to dive into, either in the blog or on the podcast, it always gives me a little bit of an extra boost when I know that I have someone out there who's really interested in what I'm presenting. So hopefully all of these topics are interesting, but if you have something in mind, please let me know and I will do my best to bring that to you. So as always, until next time, happy practicing.